Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, depending, of course, where you're coming from. Hi, my name is Vivian Aqua, and I'm certified DEI consultant trainer. And I'm excited to have this conversation. We were even talking just like 10 minutes in right now, talking about all the dits and datas about DEI and Europe and all the other challenges, you know, being a parent. How early did we wake up? But today, I am going to have a conversation which I've been actually hoping for since ever reading his book last year about conversation with Emery B. Johnson. And today's conversation is about reconstructing inclusion, leading change in the 21st century. And Emery B. Johnson, where do I begin with him, right? Emery B. Johnson is the CEO, inclusion strategist of Inclusion Wins, where he supports organizations in creating cultures that resonates from the hearts of individuals. And with a more than 20 years of experience, Emery has been instrumental in helping organizations and people achieve extraordinary business outcomes. So he's not only a DEI strategist, he's also a social capitalist, epistemologist. This is an icebreaker for my dyslexia. He's an entrepreneur. And Amri brings a unique and multifaceted perspective to his work and driving meaningful change. But the main highlight is your book. The main highlight is your book. But before we dive into your book, though, why do we need to humanize the workplace?
First, it's lovely to be able to talk to you again, Vivian. I've had a chance to talk to you over time, and I'm really excited to engage. So, why humanize the workplace beyond the what I would consider the obvious? I don't know if you ever saw the movie. It was a Netflix special. My wife is Spanish, so we always watch it in Spanish. And Casa de Papel, they call it in English. Yeah, in English they call it Money Heist or something like that. And so there was a the professor in that show. He said something towards the end of the last season, I think, to some police person. He said, "We either win, we all win, or we all lose." And when it comes to humanizing the workplace, I think that's where we are. There's, one of the chapters in my book is rooting for them out. And the words for and them are in rooting for them out. So the words for, now I can't even remember my book. The words for is in parentheses, and the word out is in parentheses. So I'm rooting for everybody. Because there is no us and them. And that was the whole point of that chapter. And in our lifetimes, we've rarely had a place where we all could come together on something that we could get behind to on in a planetary sense. COVID was that, and we didn't do a very good job. And so now I think, if we face something like that again, the consequences probably might be worse because we didn't learn. So I think there's an urgency for a human-centered workplace, and I think the workplace could actually help society. So I think there's that, it's not just us in these companies, it's us actually influencing a lot of what goes on because people spend a lot of time at work.
Underline what you were saying, like we had COVID, we had or the lockdown during the COVID season, and we didn't learn a lot from that.
We learn things we shouldn't do. So hopefully they taught us something in retrospect.
Yeah, we learned things that we shouldn't do, but then again, it also highlights the essence of companies and bosses, managers demanding people to work from the office while some people are not thriving at the workplace. Some people want hybrid. Some
Sure.
people would rather be have a remote, right? So that's where I was going. But I am curious about reconstructing inclusion. What inspired you to write this?
I think the first inspiration, reconstructing inclusion was an idea in my head since 2014. I didn't have the title, but I had a theory of change that was based on something that you're familiar with. It was cultural intelligence was a big part of my theory of change because there's so many skills and things that I think everybody should have. They should be capabilities that people build. perspective taking, metacognitive skills, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's also the, you know, designing your organization with the people in mind and letting things emerge naturally with the people. So yeah. It wasn't like, I'm going to tell you what to do because I'm the DEI expert. It mm-hmm. was people vote with their feet. Inclusion is a lot of things. Yeah. What can you do to create the conditions for people to thrive? So that was always there. And then, of course, my belief about social capital and understanding our informal networks and how much they influence how things get done in organizational life. So that was like the original thinking. And then COVID hit. And so I'm mm-hmm. writing a book. It was pretty heavily academically oriented. People that know me know that I'm probably too much like that, like more academic, and probably nobody was going to read it. You know, and so after I went through COVID, I was living here and I was really kind of just
here is where, right?
Oh, because thank you. I'm living here in Basel, Switzerland. I live in Basel. I yeah. obviously don't have a German or Italian or French accent, but I've been living here now for about a little over 5 years. And my son was really young when I started writing the book in Spain, mm-hmm. in my, mm-hmm. my wife's family's living room. I when COVID came, And I was like, whoa, I didn't know this DEI. It was yeah. like, what is this? Like, I'd been inside for so long. I just was a bit, I had blinkers. And so I was like, whoa. I was on social media like, whoa, that's not going to get us where we want to be. And mm-hmm. so the book was originally more for practitioners. And then it yeah. became about people who are in influential roles in any organization and want to do this work in a way that creates the conditions for everybody to thrive mm-hmm. through all of our humanity. I say in the book that our identity is the subset. Our humanity is the superset. And yeah. so if we're just focused on our identity, it's likely that we're going to have splinters and division versus coming together. So everybody is unique. Everybody's multidimensional, but all of us kind of belong to this common superset of humanity. And I think we were moving away from that and it was freaking me out. And so I started rewriting in a way, the basic theory of change stayed, but I started rewriting it because I saw what I'm seeing now and the kind of backlash. And so I was hoping that we didn't get there, but it was probably inevitable, the trajectory that we were on.
I mean, it's election year, right, in the US. So
Yeah, but it was happening before then. Yeah. It just came to a head mm-hmm. over the past 2 years. And mm-hmm. a lot of what happened with COVID, you know, exacerbated it, right? Yeah. People were able to be online. Obviously, social media didn't help. Mm-hmm. But I think as practitioners, we could have been a little more thoughtful about the so-called beginning with the end in mind. Like, what do we mm-hmm. really want to create? And yeah. what does this create in terms of bringing everybody to a point? Not everybody's going to go along, but I think more people would go along than we thought. And mm-hmm. so we automatically said, if you're not going to go along, you're wrong. Yeah. And that I think doesn't set up the conditions for what I see for the work and its transformational potential.
Yeah, I value that. You mentioned a little bit about being in Switzerland, and also your wife has Latin roots, right? You, in your book, you write about your personal experience in Europe and Latin America. How did that influence your views on diversity, equity, and inclusion?
Well, my wife is fully European. She's mm-hmm. from Spain. So she mm-hmm. has kind of the Hispanic roots, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So the notion of a Spanish family is very true. Mm-hmm. So that was not uncommon to me. That's pretty common to my family. That's our culture, kind of the culture I grew up with, the household I grew up with, very close family, big family. We actually, our mothers have the same number of siblings. They're not all of them are still living, but they did, right? So that was pretty a place in common. But me living in Brazil for a while and then living here, it makes you not take American exceptionalism too far, because we're kind of, American exceptionalism is somewhat built into us. And until you're outside of it and you're the American, because I never thought so much about being American until you go outside of your country. And then you're so American, like, oh my God, you're so American. And you're like, whoa, I'm American.
Yes.
And yes. You know, occasionally people will remind you of it in slight, mm-hmm. very, very subtle ways. But it's allowed me to kind of keep the mirror up and see my blind spots of how that can occur, and allow me to be a more open human being in the world and how I traverse it, and understand that my perspective is by its nature limited.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about I'm trying to think of a way of asking this question, but let me just ask this question because I forgot the person, and it's a shame that I don't remember his name, but the person, a very famous author who wrote about systems thinking, system one and system two thinking, right? And you talk
Kahneman. Yes. Mm-hmm.
You talk about this in your book where you see that the systems thinking can be effectively applied in DEI initiatives. How so?
Well, I mean, what is an organization? It's a human system. It's a human mm-hmm. community, so to speak. A community is a system. Everything is a system, the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And there's you're not one separated from the other inside of that system. You're interdependent. And so when you think about systems thinking, you're thinking about you have something in common that you're trying to create. You have a certain amount of agency when you're in the system, even though not everybody always feels like they have this agency. For a system to work, you have to be able to operate as an independent part of it, but you can't see yourself as separate from it. So you're an independent part of it, but at the same time, you can't separate yourself one from the other. That's that interdependence. You have to create team adherence and team, what I call metal, that kind of creates a glue and a ability to work through complexity and adapt. And of course, you need to be able to put these things together on a regular basis. And so it's not something that's one time, it's over and over again. So if you're thinking about a human community, you're thinking about a system, and you need to move as many of the actors as possible in that system to a particular place to be successful. That's what I mean by systems thinking with DEI. And if you build your approach with that in mind and you implement with that in mind as a DEI practitioner internal, you don't have to rely on you. And that's what a lot of us have done, is like we become the expert, and that means that we
that's have to the do mistake. Every... That's the mistake or mistake. The pitfall that companies are making or people are making.
It is. It doesn't. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You have to create the conditions for everybody to build capability. And so, I've practiced that. I've tried it out. Before I wrote Reconstructing Inclusion, I experimented with pretty much everything mm-hmm. in there, right? So it wasn't like I just like, oh, I had some ideas. I took some stuff from the internet and I started writing, or I had some lived experience and I did have the lived experience, and I had the theory and I had the practice. Mm-hmm. So all of that was there. And so I think it's in systems, if you build it with the people will take responsibility for it. What one of my colleagues says, people commit to what they help to create. And so if you're thinking in systems, you end up with a result that means if you're not there, the system still is able to move forward. If you think that way, that mm-hmm. you're the expert, the system will probably move forward, but not with the lens of DEI that you might want it to. And that's the missed opportunity when you don't do DEI with systems in mind and so-called systems thinking. I call it more systems doing than systems thinking.
What I also hear is using DEI or implementing DEI in a strategic way. Some people, enter this field with a lot of passion, mm-hmm. looking at the fun, like pride or like the celebratory moments, and not realizing that to be able to do this work, you have to think, you have to apply your strategic thinking, but also remind yourself that you have to be sustainable doing this work, or else it will drain you.
When I the subtitle of the book is I'm making DEI accessible, actionable, and sustainable. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. when I talk about accessible, I mean, it's for everybody. So everybody mm-hmm. needs to see themselves inside of this paradigm and mm-hmm. all of its breadth and depth. They need to be able to unambiguously prioritize. That's what actionable means. When people want to do something, they get into action about it and they do it with a high level of priority, appropriate level of priority. And then the sustainable, or what I might call aligned, mm-hmm. Is it's aligned with organizational purpose. It's aligned with why you're there, your raison d'etre. And if it's not, at some point, something will creep in and some naysayer will come up and say, you know, rubbish kind of stuff that's based on some political agenda. And you, it all crumbles because you didn't build it with the right principles from the beginning. You didn't get people on board and you didn't care enough to do it in the way that could be sustained. You just wanted to do stuff. So you start doing a bunch of stuff that, you know, some experts told you you should do. And it was nice. And people were like, yay, this is great. Food, fun, and flags, whatever it might be. But it doesn't, like, create the conditions for sustainability and for it to be organizationally aligned. And it's the usually, unfortunately, the downfall of a lot of efforts and, you know, complaining creeps up on social media about they don't care and whoever they are. And then you... you know, you're left with this kind of more grievance instead of more transformation.
Yeah, I get that totally. And in your book, you talk about reconstructing, but I'm also curious about how does the concept of deconstructing apply to DEI? What should be deconstructed?
I mean, deconstruction and how I identify it, it kind of overlaps with Derrida. But it also contrasts. So, you know, Derrida says that, you know, to deconstruct everything, nothing has meaning except for what we socially construct about it. I don't know if I believe that fully. I do believe that we do construct meaning around things. We're meaning making machines as humans. But for me, deconstruction in my book is more about taking, I kind of call it a cool headed look at where we are and what's manifesting and being really thoughtful and reflective about, and even critical about what we're doing, and is it creating what we want when we're practicing the work? Is it creating the conditions for everyone to thrive? Is it fostering interdependence? Is it moving us closer to our common humanity and actions reflecting our commitment to that common reality? When you start looking at it from that lens, you see your own, it's again, it goes back to systems. You see your own, you know, you put the mirror up to yourself first. And when you do that, you can see things, and maybe some things aren't going to get you where you want it to be. Even if you're fully passionate about them, they might not be what the organization needs. And you have to pivot. You have to adapt. You have to bring those who are influential in the human system along to make that shift. And that's probably one of the biggest advantages to me of the DEI work is, can you create this level of adaptability that people can make that pivot and your culture takes you through whatever challenge you're facing and not just, you know, come back and be at the baseline, but actually get better. And that's
so mentioning throughout this, or at least the foundation when it comes to the deconstruction part, you're mentioning reflection. This particular word is often skipped, or it's scary, or it's challenging for a lot of people to reflect and look back. Okay, what went well? What can we start? What can we stop? And what can we continue? And I know I may say it's so simple, but it is as simple as that, so that you can build towards that inclusive environment that you want to create together instead of yourself alone.
Yeah, absolutely, Vivian. I heard once from, I can't remember exactly who it was, but they said that strategy is getting clear on what you need to stop doing as much as it is getting clear on what you need to do.
Yeah.
And in the DEI space, we try to just keep doing things and sometimes in a particular way. So it might not be you stop something completely. It might be that you just pivot and do it differently than you did it before to get the results that you're trying to create. And when you stop those things, you just become clearer. And that's a big part of the reflection is sometimes, you know, certain things just don't work. And that's okay. That's what business is like figuring it out. And it's not like an offense to you as an individual because it doesn't work for your identity. If something gets taken out because you are passionate about it because it relates to you, if you stay stuck on that, you're never going to create the level of change that you really want to. And you probably will, you know, unfortunately, be out of a job. Or a contract or whatever. And I think, you know, we can think bigger than that. And things always come in cycles. That thing that you're really passionate about might come back and you might need to then deepen it and you'll have the space to do it because you built the relationships and the conditions to do so.
No, I want to touch upon the topic meritocracy because every time that I hear this word, I'm just like, okay, here we go again. But I need to share this. So there is this thing that if I can do it, you can do it without even thinking about, well, the way that I was brought up, the way which education I had, which education you had. And we see it back in movies and series that if they can do it, we can do it as well. It can be inspirational, but
Absolutely.
meritocracy is hurting us, particularly those who are not part of the majority, particularly also women, particularly women of color. And I wanna talk about what are the main criticisms of the concept of meritocracy when it comes to DEI.
Well, let me just be clear. Merit is good. If you have capacity, if you have skills, that's a good thing. So this is not to say meritocracy means is wrong because it means that you shouldn't have merit. And I think
Thank
that's
you for
how
sharing that.
I think that's how it's been co-opted by some to make it seem like, oh, you're less qualified and you don't believe in merit or meritocracy. And they're not the same thing. So when Baron Michael Young wrote The Rise of Meritocracy, I think it was in like 1958, right? And he wrote it because he saw that the aristocracy was now saying, oh, we're smarter because our kids do this, this, and this. And he saw it coming. So that's why he created the Open University and all these things, right? Because he wanted to give more people access to resources so that they can better themselves and build up their merit.
Which is a weird situation when what's happening right now in the world where resources are being limited. But that's a whole nother conversation.
Well, I
I'm
mean, well, yeah. I mean,
sidetracking.
I think there's places where that's happening, and that's why we need to be effective in our organizations to help those
True.
who might not have as much. Like, I'm not going to get into affirmative action right now because I have a particular view on it, but I would be considered part of that elite group of African Americans or people of African descent in the U.S. that went to elite schools. I went to, at least an elite graduate school, right? And I probably benefited to some extent from affirmative action, but I didn't need it the most because I was privileged growing up. My parents pretty much gave me whatever I needed. I didn't have any problem with that. So I would be one that if I said I'm just simply getting better than those others because I'm just better, it wouldn't be true. I've had every academic and educational advantage that anybody can say that they've had relatively in the social economic sense. Have I experienced some dynamics of racialization or racism? Yeah, but for the most part, I've had a pretty smooth path because of my family. And so the rise of meritocracy said there's going to be people that try to co-opt this to make it seem like they're better simply because they have more resources, or I'm smarter because I have more resources. And it was a satire. It wasn't meant to be taken seriously. And so we've created this kind of notion of meritocracy that's incomplete, even from the originator of the word. And so Baron Young, up until like a year before he died, he was like, y'all messed this up. I was trying to show you the future, and y'all just took it and made it like commonplace. Like, this is the thing we all want. And that's not what the point was. And so I think now, when we're talking about creating merit, we need to help those who do need the most help. And it's not always people that just because of their skin tone look like me. And so it's not that. It's everybody who needs the most help. And how can we do that more effectively? And move away from this meritocracy conversation and say we want everybody to build up and have the capacity to build their merit and their agency and their ability to make a contribution. And some people need a bit more help to do that. It's like some kid that has some type of learning difference. You'd give them enough help so that they can get to where they want to be. It's the same thing with people with a lower socioeconomic status. You give them enough help. There's a lot of gems. Diamonds, so-called diamonds in the rough, but are we actually creating the conditions for them to shine? And the answer is most of the time we're just focused on our own shining. Even DEI people don't believe me. So I think we got a lot of work to do in the way we look at merit, the way we create the conditions,
You're right. I want to talk about common misconception people might have. So what are some common misconceptions about DEI that you have personally encountered?
How much time we got? Let me look at that. the biggest one is that they're stuck. Roosevelt Thomas, who was one of my heroes in the space, I used to follow him around in Atlanta because I didn't know much about DEI, but he was the man's, right? So he passed prematurely in 2013, I think it was. And I've become friends and colleagues with his daughter, April. And so he has what is or called the diversity paradigms. He has the more civil rights, social justice paradigms, and he has the more what I would call, for lack of, I'm not saying exactly, his paradigms are more systemic, more about the organizational kind of capacity to be built. And so the social justice paradigms are, righting the past wrongs and the golden rule. And that's what most of us stay on. Like, that's what DEI is. It's righting past wrongs and the golden rule. That's part of it. And it can be incorporated. But if you just stop there, one, it's not accessible to everybody. And two, it might not be appropriate at that particular time for that particular human system that you're working in. And three, sometimes you use it to create like an advantage for yourself because you might be part of a group that was historically marginalized or racialized. And so you make it all about you. And so if you can't get out of those paradigms, it's really the social justice and civil rights paradigms, it's really hard to create systemic shifts because you get stuck and you get mad if somebody doesn't agree with you. Yeah. And DEI people need to be beacons for dissent. Like, dissent should be like our middle name. Like, if my middle name wasn't B, it would be D for dissent. Because people needs to be able to take that and be like, all right, let's think about it. Like, you sent me a lot of really good questions. So you obviously have refined your ability to ask questions, right?
Had to after doing so many interviews, but also but also realizing that there is so much power in asking a question.
Exactly.
Than making an assumption.
Exactly. And what we've done is the assumptions go whoosh.
Yeah,
I gotcha.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, that is not humanistic. It's not going to create what you want. It's going to make you feel good. You're going to get it like, you can do a little dance. But it's not going to actually create connection and contact. It's going to create the opposite. And I think if we could get out, that's the biggest one I see, is we're stuck on social justice, civil rights paradigms without understanding the whole systemic aspect of what the work can do when you practice it. More holistically.
Okay, now I'm going to challenge you on a personal level. So what are your key takeaways from your personal journey when it comes to unconscious bias? So to help you a little bit, I used to have a different narrative to those who are part of neurodivergent tribe, not realizing that I myself am neurodivergent. So the way that I dismiss people was, well, they are not as social like me, so I don't engage in any conversation, realizing that now that I know, I myself need to do my best to engage. And whoever doesn't want to engage after I've done, I've tried, then at least I've tried instead of giving up.
Yeah. So you're asking me about unconscious bias. Most DEI training doesn't work, all right, including unconscious bias training. And it doesn't work because it isn't like substantive. It doesn't work because you stop there.
Yeah.
So people do really discrete trainings. And what you're trying to do is create a learning organization in the process of learning what you need to learn to do your best work. But where does inclusion fit in there? Where do notions of equity, where you can potentially prevent those things that get in the way of people thriving, how can you address them? So rather than think about DEI as this, unconscious bias as this, like, we did it, check.
Well done.
You think about it as, all right, what do we need to do to deepen it? And that's what I did for thousands of people across the years. I started doing unconscious bias training with Howard Ross, who's an icon in the space, in 2003.
Yeah.
And so, like, I was like old school unconscious bias, right? And so, but I knew that just the course would be entertaining, and I got decent enough at it that people liked it, and it gave me high marks on my happy sheet. But I stopped doing happy sheets, and I was like, how is this impacting decision making in the most critical decisions that we need to make in our organization? And if it's not doing that, it's not creating what we need to create. Alles gut, Kai, danke.
I totally get that. As a parent myself, I totally get that. You mentioned that, okay, that the challenge of unconscious biases don't work, right? And also Harvard Business Review mentioned that a lot of unconscious bias training stop where they should continue. And that's, mm-hmm. I do have to mention, and I hope that we get to meet each other in real life so that I can show this experience with you, because I've seen a different side of unconscious biases training by using virtual reality, where people can experience, even though it's a snapshot, they can experience just 5 minutes of the challenges I face as a woman in the workplace, where you are getting maybe snarky comments, not realizing that those comments are, there is a layer of power in it. There can be also a layer of performance bias in it. There can also be a layer of other biases, other challenges absolutely. That women are facing in it. And it's compounded. And to be able to explain that, that's also a challenge for a person to share that. And for you also, the receiver, for you to believe what is being shared by being told about your colleague that you see is amazing colleague, right? That's the challenge.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, you know, I think the kind of dialogue that you just entered into kind of with me around that, mm-hmm. I think that can be transformational too. I think most of the prejudice we experience is because we don't have enough contact with each other. Mm. And the more we don't have enough contact with each other, we're not necessarily pursuing something kind of in a way that is impacting us in an interdependent way intentionally, mm-hmm. even though all organizational life is interdependent. You need to have some practice at doing that with the so-called other. I say so-called because, you know, I don't believe in the notion of other. So if we have the contact, if we do it consistently, and we have this common goal, we do it over time, and we have a support from our institutions or organizations, prejudice usually goes down. And there's a lot of research base behind that. And
You have to create
those spaces.
Yeah.
That's a big, that level of facilitation, I think, is where, you know, a really good DEI practitioner does that and creates, works to get other people to be able to do it too. So it's not just on them. It's like they're creating the space for more and more people to do that. And it's not easy because it can't be all about you. It really has to be about the people. And it's got to be about care. You got to be open. You got to create safety. You got to build trust. All those things are there.
Build your poker face as well, which is not.
Yeah, I mean, you can build your poker face, or you can do the one eye raise like I often do. If you've seen me on social media, sometimes I'm like, I don't know about what they just said, but I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to go down the rabbit hole. I don't have time. So if you ever see me on social media, I have one eye lifted or something on my chin, is because I'm like, that's weird. That doesn't make sense, but I don't have time to interrogate.
When I see that, I will ask you about it.
Yeah.
Another question that I have is, what are your takeaways on coaching executives, managers, when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion?
I think people... And this kind of gets to this backlash of DEI that's primarily happening in the U.S., but slowly moving further east to the U.K. and English sphere across the world.
Europe in general, it's reaching Europe as well.
It's happening, right? And because people don't really, they're attacking these letters, DEI. Yeah. Who really knows what it means, right? I have one definition. Another person has another definition. I do what I think works for my clients. Other people do what they think works for them or their clients, right? Mm-hmm. And so they're not attacking DEI. They're attacking, you know, anti-racism. They're attacking critical race theory. They're attacking maybe even intersectionality, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't really fully understand the constructs. And if you really talk to them about it, most of them. I have a lot of people. I spend a lot of time on Substack, and I tell people, like, yeah, some of this stuff is not good, but here is what I understand about it. And so we can have that debate, or we can have that dialogue, and I can have a different conversation about that. And so I don't remember your whole question. I was going somewhere with this. What was the question?
The question was, what are your takeaways when it comes to coaching executives and managers?
So when I'm coaching anybody, I don't do a lot of coaching, but I do a good amount as an internal advisor. I'm really just asking questions to see where people are and what they'd like to create in the organization where culture is concerned. So I get away from DEI because it's loaded, right? It's a loaded construct that is, for some people, it's very ideological. And I don't see it. It's principle centered for me, but a lot of people, it's an ideological construct that's based on X. And my principles are based on many things that predate all of us, that go back to, you know, Confucius or what have you. You know, it's a long time back there. And so because I think like that, when I coach, I'm just opening people up to build enough trust that they can say, oh, what I'm doing is inclusion when I want to do this for my team. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, so if I do more of this, this will create the conditions for my people to thrive. And if I don't, if I do these other things, it gets in the way of stuff getting done. And so it's that simple. It's never like, okay, let me tell you what DEI is, and you're going to then adhere to everything I tell you. People don't listen to what you tell them.
Also, I do believe that a company has a DEI recipe. Like, that's how I look at DEI, where a company is sharing their narrative of how they see diversity, equity, and inclusion being ingrained within their organization, whilst you also have teams. Teams also have their own recipe. It builds upon the organizational recipe, but they can tweak it. Yeah, and then you have your individual recipe, as in what I find important within inclusion is totally different than what you and what somebody else thinks when it comes to inclusion, right? And we often forget that we have these different recipes or different recipe variations that we can tweak and craft, as long as it's, you know, supportive of inclusion, you can tweak and craft it.
And you have to. I mean, every organization has a culture, you know, super cultures and subcultures, right? Yeah. That is the nature of humanity, the nature of any organization, at least.
Yeah.
And if they do create something that works for their team, that's another opportunity to share the way things work around here, which is culture, which also might be helpful to somebody else. So once you start seeing those microcultures or subcultures in your organization, let people tell stories about what they're doing, what they're creating, how they're creating the conditions for people to thrive. To me, that's the best situation you can be in, is when people are out there doing things that create the right conditions for thriving all over the place. Because then you look like a superstar as you walk through, like, the DEI. Look at me. Let me tell this story. I'm going to start me a podcast, and I'm going to tell all y'all the stories about all the great stuff we're doing in our organization. Mm-hmm. That is the ideal situation, I believe, for people. And if we do more of that, I think, and recognize how valuable and I think I'd say, you know, absolutely necessary and essential it is, we all come out better, and particularly our organizations and those that we're committed to as clients, as consultants.
Definitely. Before I hit the button, you know, we can start the stream. We were talking about US versus Europe, where things are done differently. And you also mentioned, like, your wish, your hope for Europe. What is it that you were about to say when it comes to Europe and diversity, equity, and inclusion?
I think Europe has been really, I think Europe has focused a little more on inclusion because of the dynamics of how race shows up in Europe. And so I'm not upset about that. A lot of people have been upset about it. I think I don't have to be upset. I mean, we know, you know, there's a lot of conversations about racism, what it isn't, right? but obviously our skin tones and the way we look influences the way some people think about us. Yeah. And I'm not saying us is just, you know, being a brown person, but us being mm-hmm. anybody who's either racialized or comes from a place that's not necessarily where they live now. Right.
Yeah.
So these things happen. I think we can work on those dynamics, and we can do it with the lens of a common humanity at the center differently than we have in the US. I think if we had taken what the US is doing, like we're seeing in the UK and somewhat in Australia now, I think if we have to kind of bank on that way of mm-hmm. being and doing, I don't think it actually is going to create what we want to create here.
That's also one of the reasons why many clients are saying that we don't want the US narrative, because it doesn't always apply to what we are doing here.
And Vivian, it doesn't even always apply to US companies. And that's the problem. It doesn't always work in US companies. And what we're seeing now is people weren't getting results from the so-called racial reckoning. And so now we're in a place where in Europe, we can actually do this in a way that actually fulfills on DEI's transformative potential, which I think mm-hmm. actually is about our common humanity and all of our subsets. And when we can do that and we can create more contact, we're actually just going to have better workplaces, so we get more done in a way that serves the company's needs, particularly in the changing times that companies are going through now, and they mm-hmm. will continue to go through. And do they have the capacity to adapt with all this difference and similarity in organizational life? And so I'm excited about the potential for Europe, Middle East, Africa, Asia.
You're just naming the whole world.
I'll still love my country and still do work in my country.
Yeah.
And I think the opportunity to really tell stories from this side of the pond in a more robust way has never been better, especially because of the so-called attacks. Mm-hmm. I think the attacks are the best opportunity we've ever had for transformation. If you never had them, you would never know what you need to do to transform.
And are you referring to the attacks regarding DEI, how it's being attacked?
Yeah, like just people, and you can call them attacks. It's really just mm-hmm. people criticizing stuff for political gain. It's not mm-hmm. real. And in some people, some of the criticism is very legitimate, and we should be listening to it. We should be engaging mm-hmm. with it. And what we're doing is we're pushing back and saying, well, let me tell you why DEI is right and you're wrong. Like, that doesn't create anything of substance. All it does is create contention. And you're just defending your position because that's what you've banked on all this time. And I get it. I'm not trying to take money out of people's pockets. But if you pivot and you deepen, you'll probably make more money if that's what you're in it for, right? But just fighting back on people and making them wrong and you right, that's righteousness has never transformed anything. Self-righteousness, rather, has never transformed anything. Righteousness is a virtue. Self-righteousness is basically just an ego trip.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation about the ego. But I'm curious, do you have a question for me that you want me to answer?
You know, I think if we have time, I'm really you've been in the Netherlands for a while.
Mm-hmm.
How much has Ghanaian culture influenced your circle of friends? Because you're pretty magnanimous in the way you engage with the world.
I would say, yeah, I'm born and raised within the Ghanaian community here in the Netherlands, but uh-huh. I'm more of a global citizen within the Netherlands or Amsterdam. So my community or my tribe of people, they come from everywhere, not only Ghana, right? I know friends who surround themselves with a lot of Ghanaians around them, and I'm more of a globetrotter when it comes to that. I think that you notice it with the conversations that I'm having, but also with when you see my tight network or the people that I introduce. I try to open people up into an international network instead of cocooning within just one box, because it doesn't serve me.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's also another thing that I value and honor my Ghanaian roots, but I also had to unlearn a lot of the Ghanaian upbringing. And one of the things that I want to share is me starting this journey as a speaker or as a trainer or anything that has to do with me owning up a stage, that means also that I have to share my story, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the things that I've been told not to do is share, you know, my dirty laundry, which I don't see as dirty, which I see as a way of me going through a challenging period or a challenging state, or me even disclosing that I'm neurodivergent, me disclosing about my ankle. Mm-hmm. I see that as a way to share stories and tell other people about the things that I encounter that is hurting inclusion.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it.
I love our food. That's something that I'll never work away from.
Now, let me be clear, y'all.
I will defend the Ghanaian jollof till I die. So that's something that I have to mention. I will be...
You'll go toe-to-toe with the Nigerians, huh? You're like, okay.
With everybody in West Africa, there is nothing that can be better than the Ghanaian jollof. That's it. That's period.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. And another question.
That's it for me. I have some questions that I want to ask you in person.
Hold
until we see each other in the fall when I'm there.
I enjoyed this conversation. It was, in full transparency, we because Marjolein Vlug and myself interviewed Amri for the Global Inclusion in Practice podcast. And I was just like, oh, I need to also interview him about his book. But I felt like, okay, maybe it's too soon, but there will be definitely, you know, in the upcoming months, his episode will come out with Marjolein Vlug and myself, where we'll talk about how it feels to be the DEI practitioner or the DEI trainer or consultant that you are. But I wanted to also dive into your book.
Well, I sincerely appreciate it. It was delightful to have the time with you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. So for everybody who is listening or maybe is watching the replay, know where to reach Amri. I think that via social media, so LinkedIn. He's very active on
Amri,
LinkedIn.
Amri B. Johnson, my company, inclusionwins.com. We have a podcast and a Substack, so all under the same name, Reconstructing Inclusion. And I would love to engage. And I take all feedback, the good, the bad, the ugly.
That's how I see it. Somebody recently told me that see feedback as feed forward, right?
Feed forward is beautiful. I just wrote something up for a client about feed forward today. Mm-hmm. So you're reading.
Oh, I was there.
You were.
Thank you so much for this conversation. And if you have any questions, reach out and see you till the next time.
Bye, everybody. Thank you, Vivian. Make it a great one.